So I'm going to do this alphabetically, and I'll just introduce Carl Hanlon. And this came from his staff. I didn't invent this. Okay.
All right, so if they make fun of me in this.
Yeah. He is a rancher, water lawyer, and the city attorney from Glenwood Springs, who's never taken a dime of corporate PAC money and never will. And he and his wife, Cheryl, run a nonprofit that provides therapy for veterans with PTSD and children with autism. In Congress, Carl will stand up to Donald Trump, fight for universal health care, and stop Trump, Pruitt, and Zinke from selling off and exploiting our public land. Okay, and then, let's see, here's another cookie on Diane. Ms. Bush is a former two-term Rapp County Commissioner and former three-term Colorado State House Representative. She stands up for her constituents and works across the aisle for practical solutions. She received a PhD in, I think, sociology, or is that correct? And she was a college professor. Her record shows that she's consistently fought for people, the economy, and the environment of rural Colorado to get things done. The people who call our district home need strong representation and a champion for the Western Slope and Southern Colorado. Okay. Aaron Minconi, and this also came from his website, or give it to someone. So he served as Eagle County Commissioner from 2000 to 2008, served on numerous community and statewide nonprofit boards, and has worked on community development initiatives, which include long-term economic planning, affordable housing, and early childhood development. He is known as a progressive leader in sustainability and social justice. He also founded Snowboard Outreach,
SOS,
okay, which is a nonprofit that provides funding and activities for youth at risk, and he manages those programs and resources. He received an MBA from the University of Denver. Okay, Diane, you go first, okay?
Sure. I've been a lifelong progressive activist. Growing up in Minnesota, I worked and volunteered for a wide variety of progressive groups. My mother taught me when I was a kid that we're here to make the world better for everyone, and that public service is something that we all need to do, but we all do it in very different ways. I moved to Colorado 41 years ago to Rapp County, to Steamboat Springs, and immediately I got involved with ranchers and conservation groups on water and land issues, and that's been one of my passions and one of my policy areas ever since. I also have been deeply involved in a wide variety of women's equity issues, from family medical leave to pay equity. I was once the president of a safe house for battered women and their children. So across a wide variety of issues, I've been a progressive activist. But then that wasn't enough, so I ran for office. I ran to be a county commissioner. And I won twice and put into play a wide variety of progressive policies that made people's lives better. Then I realized that the state was keeping us in Rapp County from doing all these good things that we'd gotten community consensus on. So I ran for the state house. I won three times. My campaign is a grassroots campaign. That's why I've been endorsed, and you have some handouts there, 8.5 by 11, on the groups who've endorsed me. I've been endorsed by the Progressive Democrats of America as the candidate in this primary. The reason they endorse me is because I have a proven record of implementing progressive policy that matters and helps people's lives. They have a very intense interview process, big questionnaire, and then a second interview process. So I'm very honored that they've endorsed me. I've also been endorsed by the AFL-CIO of Colorado, 130,000 working people strong, from firefighters to teachers to manufacturing workers. And they endorsed me because they believe that I am the one who can beat Scott Tipton, and they also endorsed me because of my progressive record of actually walking the talk and getting things done. I've had a whole host of other endorsements that I'm very proud of and very humbled about, but we'll leave it at that for now. I'm running a grassroots campaign. I have had over 1,100 donations from people all over this district. Over 77% of those have been $100 or less. I don't rely on big donors, and I've taken the No Corporate PAC pledge, and I've taken the No Fossil Fuel pledge. I've also taken the Colorado Clean Campaign pledge, and I think it's really important for all of us to walk the walk in terms of doing a clean campaign and relying on the people.
Okay, I'm gonna stand up. We've been sitting down for 2.5 days now. And I also tend to pace, so if I whack anybody, it's not intentional. So thank you guys all for coming out today. It is amazing to have you here at noon on a work day in Glenwood Springs. And so my deepest and sincerest thanks, because if you weren't here doing this or at work, it's beautiful outside, spring is here, and so there are so many things you can be outside doing. You know, and we just started this campaign a short 5 months ago, and it has been humbling and awe-inspiring, the support that I have received, that this campaign has received. And it is from an amazing range of people, from the most progressive activists to champions in the choice community, to Democratic activists, to ranchers and farmers, and honestly, folks from every party that have shown up and supported this campaign. It is the true definition of a grassroots campaign. I'm a citizen candidate. I am running for all of those reasons that we all strive for, about going out and doing the best for our community. And this campaign, this grassroots campaign, shocked the establishment on the state assembly night, when nobody thought we would make the ballot, and we made the ballot, and we made it comfortably. You know, when we started this campaign, and I don't know if Nathan, if he's standing out, he's outside, so there's space in here. I started out with a young campaign manager, and when we started this, we sat down and said, this is something special, something we want to do differently. And that was to do this without corporate PAC money. We were the first to come into this race and say, we will not take corporate PAC money, we have not taken corporate PAC money, and we will never take corporate PAC money. And the reason for that is, as soon as you start down that path, you start building relationships and entwine yourself in a world that you can never fully extricate yourself from. And we see that now when you look to our president, or Zinke, or Pruitt, or our favorite person in the room, Scott Tipton. They have made those relationships, they have built those communities around themselves, and they are willing to sell off any and all of our public lands, our health care, pretty much anything that is up for sale that you can imagine, they're willing to sell off. That's what we have to push back against. That's why we have to take the walk and the talk to the United States Congress. I've been a rancher, I've been a park ranger, I've been an attorney, I've been a husband, I've been a father, and I have done all of those things here in this district. This is where I started, and this is where I landed, and I have stayed. And I will tell you, I love the communities of this district more than anything. And you all who know me here in Glenwood and in the Valley know how hard I have worked for our communities, and in particular, Glenwood has been a client for a long time that I've worked for almost 17 years. So I'm really looking forward to winning this election. I'm also looking forward to the conversation about issues. Arne and Diane have been fantastic to be up here with. If Arne wants me to, I may be able to do his opening. We were just talking about that. So,
my name's Arne Menconi. Thank you for being here. This is so cool to see at this time of the year, with elections in November, that you people are caring so much about what's going on. I'm scared to death about what's going on in America right now, and that's why I jumped into this race. I'm scared to death of these endless wars, of the global warming, of the inequality gap, and the racial injustice that's been going on, and it's getting worse and worse. It's not getting better. You know, I turned 59 in a couple of weeks, and I have an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old, and I don't have hope, I have kids. Because when I see the trajectory of just the inequality gap, where the rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer, I don't see how that's going to turn around. Global warming, we're probably going to get into it, and how we watch how it's accelerating. I think it's 120 in Phoenix today, and in Egypt it's 113 today. You know, racial injustice. Let's talk about this a little bit, and that is, I've been going around this the district. And mostly we're talking to white people. You know, I've been in Black Lives Matter protests in New York and in Washington, D.C. I've worked with Pamela Meeks, the former president of the National Bar Association on how to stop police brutality and bring legislation that could stop the killing of black men. And then on Inequality Gap, Racial Injustice, I feel like Rick Perry here, you know, Secretary of Education, or some version of that. So those are the four areas that I feel that my policies and my work are always going to work around and try to create solutions around. And why is that? Because we live in an oligarchy. How many people feel that we live in an oligarchy? Raise your hand, okay? I campaigned for Bernie Sanders. I gave him $100 when he jumped into the race. I'm a Bernie-crat. If it wasn't for Bernie, we wouldn't be able to say that. We wouldn't have been able to talk about universal health care and expanding Medicare for all. He's been able to say things that it's now safe for us to say. And as a progressive who's come out when I was getting petitions in order to get on the ballot, I said three things. I said, I'm for banning assault weapons, I'm for banning fracking, and I'm for impeaching Donald Trump. I think now we have the urgency of now, right now, and we've got to jump into this. Today I jumped online and I saw that Cory Gardner, if I get elected, my number one thrill is going to be driving that man insane. Okay? I can't tell you a politician I dislike next to Trump more than him. I put him in the same category. Cory Gardner was rated 8 out of 100 senators as the most bipartisan senators. Michael Bennett was 38. This is crazy when Cory Gardner starts looking like the bipartisan one. Thank you very much.
What do you think makes you a better candidate to topple Tipton in the November election than your Democratic primary contenders?
You know, this is really the question is how do we win in November, right? That's really the question, and great candidates up here, and so you guys have a tough choice. But let's talk about what we need to do and how we need to do it. The things we know we do well in this district are we win in counties like Rauch County, Eagle County, La Plata County, Alamosa County, right? Those are the places we win all the time. We lost in Pueblo by about 11 points. We lost out in Mesa County by almost 39 in the last cycle. Those numbers unfortunately keep trending up, not down for us. So what that really means for us to win this election is that we have to be able to expand our map. We have to expand where we are successful and how we connect with people. And I would point to my experience working on, say, the Colorado River Cooperative Agreement, 25 plus jurisdictions up and down the Colorado River, plus Denver Water. As you can imagine, the politics are a little different in Summit County than they are in Mesa County. And so when you put together that kind of a coalition and you work through those issues over that period of time, you understand that what wins this district is being nonpartisan. Well, actually, we have a saying in the water world, it's being partisan for the Western Slope, right? That's what you have to do, is you work on the issues, you cut across the rhetoric, you stay focused on the issues, not the ideology. And that's where I am uniquely positioned to be able to do that. I have a long history in this district and a wide variety of roles that I've had, from that rancher to that park ranger to the water attorney to the municipal attorney, working across all of those bands of folks where we can push out into those areas to be able to have conversations and pull people back in. When you're down having a beer with a guy on the line who isn't looking to his leadership in the AFL for how he's gonna vote, you know, remember, AFL endorsed the last candidate for this race, rank and file voted against him. You gotta be able to sit down, have a beer with them, and make sure that you believe in them and they believe in you.
And now Arne.
Yeah. You gotta be nuts to run for office, some people say, right? I see Doris, she's here, she's been in politics. Politics is, campaigns are a refining fire. And the reason I'm on fire right now is, as I told you before, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not gonna take it anymore. And that's what I'm seeing in the population. Let's look at District 3. It hasn't been a targeted district in the 25 years that I've lived here, all right? Gail Schwartz lost by 14 points and had $1.4 million. I voted for her, I supported her. She had the pedigree, but she still lost that badly. So before I jump in this and sacrifice my time and miss my kids' baseball games and all of those type of things, you start to think, what is the reality check here of winning? Well, the reality check is people are disenfranchised, people are angry, people are outraged. And my passion and the ability to communicate why we should be outraged and why the people who don't come to the polls and vote is the difference that will be in this election cycle. We know that Democrats are as mad as hell and can't take it anymore, and that they're going to go to the ballots and vote. But this is a midterm election, and the person who's been in a lot of campaigns over the last 25 years follows the numbers and watches what Pace happened. What happened with Pace when he ran? What happened with Tapia when he ran? They lost, and they lost because they didn't give a message that was strong enough to the independent voters and to the young people's voters. And you have to talk common sense. I have been going back and forth to Washington for 25 years, lobbying, getting arrested, whatever it takes in order to deliver a message that we're going into endless wars, and Donald's Trump authoritarian regime that's taking place right now has to stop, and that's scaring people, and they'll bring in the independent voters, the disenfranchised voters, and the young people.
Thank you. I've won 5 elections, and some say it was easy to win them, but I won them in a district. First, when I was a commissioner, there was a Republican incumbent. 27% of the voters were Democrats. The key was the unaffiliateds and the moderate Republicans. Fast forward to 2016, a very bad year for us. I won re-election to the Colorado House of Representatives in a district with 29% Democrats, where the plurality, again, were unaffiliated by 60.7%. I know how to win this district because I've won in districts like it. Part of winning is being in all 29 counties, knowing people, listening to them. That's the key. Each county is unique. Each county has its own sets of issues, but there are issues that tie all 29 together. Two of them that are key for all 29, not just the Western Slope, which I've been honored to represent for a long time, are the economy. It's an economy that Tipton and Trump and this Congress have built for the top 1%, not for working people. And I've been going around in Pueblo and all over since July, listening to how people feel about that. And they are angry. Angry about the inequality, angry about the lack of fairness, and they're ready to go. The second issue that ties us all together is our healthcare crisis, and we'll be, I'm sure, talking more about that. But I am the one with the experience in that issue, and one of your handouts shows that I'm the only candidate here who has won a champion rating on healthcare. Everywhere I've gone, everybody I've talked to and listened to has brought up healthcare. It is critical, and we'll talk, I'm sure, more specifically. But the main reason I will beat Scott Tipton is that I have a real grassroots campaign. I have people who believe in me in every county, who've given their hard-earned dollars, whether it's 5 or something else.
Okay. Let's see. Next question is, what is your position on Second Amendment gun rights? Would you introduce a bill that bans semi-automatic / assault weapons, gun bump stocks, and mandate universal background checks? Any other positions you want to take on this? I think we'll just
keep rotating across.
Well, as I said earlier, I jumped into this race because the first thing I said is banning assault weapons. Right? Why did I do that? A few days after Valentine's Day, the kids in Parkland, Florida broke my heart when they said, adults have failed us. And when you're a white guy who's won the lottery and have a master's degree and have worked in politics and have worked in nonprofits and have worked in for-profit businesses, you say, I've got to jump out there and I've got to fight for these young people. And so, yes, to all of that, I've even considered repealing the Second Amendment. It's just getting crazy when we're listening to high schoolers and young people who are ages of 7 saying that they're afraid to go to school all over America. And you know why this is happening? This is happening because we live in a weapons-based economy. Look at how many weapons have been sold over the last 10 or 30 years. Do you know how much money was spent to be in the Middle East for the past 15 years? $7 trillion. This is the military-industrial security congressional complex on steroids. And what happens when you start weaponizing the world, it starts to get into the police departments. And now our police departments are looking like military departments. And then it gets down into the hands of individuals like young people who shouldn't have guns. So I'm going to never vote for a defense budget. And I don't think there should be an elected official who votes for a defense budget. And I will continue, I don't care what it takes. When I say I get arrested, I don't mean it as a joke. It's called civil disobedience. When you get pulled out of a Senate hearing with John Kerry and say, I don't want deja vu all over again. You can't be a little pregnant in the Middle East. The death of innocent lives, creating more terrorism. And now it's coming back home to haunt us. It's only going to get worse, folks, and this is not a conventional election.
Thank you.
Thank you. I didn't get on this issue just in 2018. In 2013, as a member of the Colorado House, I voted for universal background checks, and I voted for magazine limits. Before the vote, the NRA and the gun lobby, don't forget the gun manufacturing lobby, it's not just the NRA, were on my case. They were on me like a wetsuit every day. I voted the way my conscience and my constituents wanted me to vote, and that was for both of those. I got attacked in the local newspaper. She doesn't believe in the Constitution. You have to not elect her next time. Well, I want handling next time. And I know how to fight the NRA. I know how to fight gun manufacturers. We need an assault weapons ban. We need this common sense Colorado bill for universal background checks. It's worked. We've prevented violent convicted felons. Not people thought to be on some list, but people who've been convicted of sexual assault, of domestic violence, of assault with a deadly weapon. Serious criminals, we've prevented them every year since 2013 from getting a weapon. That will be the first bill I would like to introduce. It's a common sense bill, we know it works. And that's why I've been endorsed by the Progressive Democrats of America and by a new group, Blue Rising. It's a group of women who are concerned with women's issues, the environment, and gun safety. And they had a very deep and incisive interview process with a questionnaire. They've endorsed me as the preferred candidate largely because of that position I've taken. I don't just talk about gun safety. I've walked the walk, I've been attacked by the NRA, and I know how to stand up to the NRA. And I promise you, I will do that in the U.S. Congress.
I think that for all of us up here, we can all say, assault weapons ban, bump stocks, magazine capacity, universal background checks. I think what I'd like to talk about, because that is my position, what I'd like to talk about is how that is framed from my perspective. As you all know, I grew up on a ranch where a gun was a tool. I carried one as a park ranger. I have been a lifelong gun owner. So when I come to this issue, when I talk to people about this issue, it is as a gun owner who has his entire life been a responsible gun owner. But let me tell you what is not going on, and I'm going to start it with a story about my daughter. After Parkland, I was cooking dinner, and my daughter was across the counter doing homework. And as a parent, you know, there are those moments when it's time for that conversation. And so I asked Zoe what her thoughts were on what was going on, and she said, Dad, she's a senior in high school at Warren Fort. She said, Dad, I know where every exit is from every classroom. I know what furniture I can pile in front of the door. I know what I can use for a weapon in the room, and I know what the exit strategy is for all of my friends. I will tell you that may have been the hardest conversation I have ever had with my daughter. And what I find offensive is that we have a coward on the House floor in Paul Ryan who said, this conversation is too hard for us to have. We can't have this conversation about guns and violence in our communities. If I had to have that conversation, if every one of you had to have that conversation with your child, you know how hard that conversation is. It is cowardice for us not to be having these as politicians. And the reason we're not having them is the money. If we can get the money out of the conversation, then at least we can talk about it. And all of these things that we're talking about can appear on the House floor. But until we do that, until we push that cowardice aside, we're stuck where we're at.
Thank you. Next question is, Do you believe health care is a universal right in the United States? Do you favor expanded Medicare for all with a single government payer? If not, why not? And if you do favor those improvements, how would you go about financing that? So, where do you go? Diane?
Yes. Universal single-payer health care has long been, not just in this election, but long been a policy preference of mine. And yes, I will co-sponsor H.R. 676, which is the Conyers bill, for Medicare for all. I would, however, offer an amendment to it, and I've already let people in the House know that. We live in rural areas. That bill, like so many bills, is crafted by primarily urban and suburban legislators, just as what happens at the Colorado House. Right now, the bill does not provide for ambulance and EMS service. And I understand why it doesn't in urban areas, because it's very expensive, and besides, hospitals aren't far away. But out here, there are some in this district who live more than an hour from the nearest trauma center. So the amendment that I would suggest, and I will propose, is that an hour or more, or a certain distance or more, whichever we decide on, those folks get covered. But let's get to the heart of it. Single-payer universal health care, although we'll be able to pass it, we'll be able to pass something like H.R. 676, as long as Donald Trump or Mike Pence are the president, they're going to veto it. So in the meanwhile, what we need to do is shore up the ACA, fix the glitches like the cliff effect, the two-earner effect, and also strongly support and fund our federally qualified health clinics. They are critical in our counties, right here in Garfield County. We also need to support and fully fund CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. So many young families rely on it. They can't pay their kids the health insurance premiums without it. We also need to protect Medicare. Ryan McConnell et al. Have put it on the chopping block because they increased the deficit. Gee, why did they do that? Because of a giveaway to the top 1% in the tax bill. So we need to do a variety of things over time.
Thank you. So absolutely universal, accessible, affordable health care is a right in this country. I think what we learned from watching the long fight with the ACA over the last 10 years as we passed a massive change in our health policy and then 10 years of a battle to try to keep it in place is that those large policy changes are very hard to accomplish, they're very hard to institute, and as the question implicates, it is going to be very expensive to do. But here's what I do know. I know that I pay more for my health insurance than I do my mortgage every single month. I know that there are citizens, constituents all across this district who cannot afford health insurance anymore, and that I need to do something now, to help with that problem, because we cannot wait for another massive policy shift. So what are the types of things that we can do now to make an impact and make a difference in people's lives? I'm going to give you three ideas. One, single rating district for the state of Colorado. It failed in our state legislature. Now it's time to take it to the national legislature. It would help not only us, but other rural states like us. It would lower our rates about 25% for health insurance, increase them maybe 2% on the front range. Second, transparency in the process. How much does the Band-Aid cost? How much are you charged for the Band-Aid? What's the outcome when the Band-Aid gets used? You can talk to a rural health clinic. They will tell you that will help them on the cost side so that they're not being charged 30 cents for something that is being charged 3 cents for in Denver. As a consumer, you can see how that would help you out. And then understanding outcomes is incredibly important. Third one is to, the ACA was based on competition, which we don't have in rural America. So let's do a buy-in to Medicaid to create that competition. It's something we can do right now to create that competition and drive costs down, because we need change now, immediately, not sometime in the future.
I don't know if we're shouting here, but there's a fan on here, yeah. So we're trying to talk really loud so everyone can hear. How many people here are on Obamacare? Raise your hand. How many people here are getting their health insurance from their employer? How many people are on Medicaid or Medicare? And how many people don't have health insurance? Okay? This is going to get worse. In September of last year, I was pulled out of the Senate building arrested in handcuffs with 200 people in wheelchairs from Adaptive because they're going to repeal Obamacare. That's how hard I fight for things. And now that they're making changes to Obamacare, it's going to get more and more expensive, and we're looking at premiums for a family of four between $1,000 and $2,000. And when somebody like us gets up and says we're for universal health care for all, I have three ways that I'm for universal health. Look, I'm not going to use it. Where is the money going to come from? You always get where the money is going to come from. The money's going to come from the military budget, which is a $700 billion budget that continues to grow. You know, the Republican plan is usually something like deregulate, privatize, and spend money on hardware inside of the military. And that is their business plan. And you got to have money in order to not only do universal health care or Medicaid for all, but we have to fund early childhood development. So kids starting now, kids don't get to pick their parents. And if we could spend money in early childhood development, long-time savings is huge, huge. So there's always going to be the question of how you're going to spend it. We have to talk about how we're getting ripped off in our military budget and being able to afford other things for it.
What is your opinion on the income wealth gap in the United States? Would you make any changes to the tax code, or would you do something else? Do you favor a $15 minimum wage, and if so, by when? And we're going to just go break down.
I'm for $15 an hour minimum wage. I've tried to start it. I talked to Governor Diglam. I met with him 2 years ago, and I said, how can we get this initiated? I tried to get Democratic County Commissioners from Eagle County, where I'd come from, to fight for it, and it was very, very, very hard to do that. The inequality gap that I talked about before, when did this kind of start? It started with Ronald Reagan and the Reagan Revolution. And then who helped it even further? Bill Clinton. You know, I mean, I've been very, very critical, obviously, of the Democratic Party, because I feel like the Democratic Party left me. I feel like the Democratic Party left the people. When you see where the money's coming from for these political campaigns, it's coming from either the oil and gas industry, it's coming from big agriculture, it's coming from big pharma and health, it's coming from the finance industry, and it's coming from the military. Follow the money, folks. That's where most of the money comes from. That's where most of the legislation benefits. And who gets ripped off? The 99%. And this is why we have to talk about the big picture, or pull back the aperture and look at where we're being ripped off, not just by the Republicans, but by the Democrats. We need our Democratic leaders like Senator Bennett and Governor Hickenlooper to talk about $15 an hour minimum wage. I supported, for example, Amendment 69. I couldn't get hardly any elected official who was a Democrat to support Amendment 69. Those are the things that leaders do, fight for the people.
You still have 19 seconds.
All right, that was an incredibly broad question, so we're going to hit some highlights as we move across it. Let's start with minimum wage. Absolutely support increasing the minimum wage. I think the $15 number is kind of an arbitrary pick number. I think what's important is to create a living wage in the communities all across the district, and so that will vary dramatically depending on where you're at. We've seen more and more as communities across the country and in Colorado start to take a look at what is a living wage in their communities and setting minimum wage there. I think that's a good approach on determining what the right number is, but absolutely it needs to go up. How do we address the tax plan? Well, one, it's not a plan. It's at best a bill that got passed, and it probably is really a giveaway if you really think about it. So addressing the inequalities that are pushed forward with that tax bill are absolutely critical. We need to increase those upper brackets. Again, I think the right move should have been is that those tax cuts for the lower brackets went on in perpetuity, if you will, and the higher ones never happened at all. We need to get back to a tax plan that helps the middle class, not the upper 1%. We absolutely have to do that. The other thing that we can do to start addressing so many of the issues that we have on wage inequality and earning inequality is shoring up our public schools. We have in DeVos one of the worst things that has ever happened to public education in this country. And you guys can take a look. Floating around is, I put out a very detailed policy plan on education, things that we can do to increase the number of teachers we have. We have a horrible teacher shortage, trying to help rural and disadvantaged districts to make sure that they have the kind of teaching staff that they really need, bringing more funding to the table by fully funding the IDEA, which is an incredibly important act on disabilities. Those are the kinds of things we can do, but it is a policy focused on the middle class all across the board to start addressing that wage and income inequality that we have in the country today.